So good morning, Professor Hertz. Thank you very much for joining us. As we've discussed ahead of this interview, we will be discussing the period during which ideas behind replica symmetry breaking and spinning glasses were developed, which we roughly bound from 1975 to 1995. But before we get to that, we have a few questions on background, if you don't mind. Sure. In particular, could you tell us a bit about your family and your studies before starting university?
I grew up in an academic family in Pennsylvania. And I went to high school in Connecticut. It was a private school. And from there, I went to Harvard, where I studied physics as an undergraduate, and then on to Pennsylvania for graduate school.
So what first got you interested in physics and then to pursue graduate studies in physics?
I think when I started university, I didn't know whether I'd want to do physics or maths. And then I found out what real maths was, and it was a little bit an abstract challenge to me, and I've just felt more on native turf or something in physics. And I remember in particular in my first year in the physics library discovering Feynman's lectures on physics, which I read like it was a novel. I just couldn't put it down. I'll let you continue.
Oh, no. I mean, what then drew you to...
That's how it started.
What then drew you to UPenn to work with Bob Schrieffer in theoretical physics?
In my final undergraduate year, I met my wife-to-be, and we got married the summer after we graduated. So we planned on looking for graduate schools together. She was in psychology, and we had a number of options, but Penn seemed to be the optimal thing, the joint optimum, maybe not either the top one for either of us, but the best jointly. So we went to Penn, and I think I remember talking with my in-laws just before we went there. And I think already then I thought I wanted to work on superconductivity. So I knew about Bob Schrieffer, although I'd never met him or anything. And initially I thought I'd be an experimentalist, but I tried that for half a year or something and proved to be all thumbs. It seemed to be an experimentalist. You really had to, or at least in the lab I was working in, you had to be one of these guys who'd played around building electronics as a kid. And I'd never done that. I was really more mathematically oriented. So realizing that an experimental career probably wasn't for me, I explored theoretical possibilities at Penn, where there were a number of good people. And I was lucky on the qualifying exam to score high, so I could basically choose who I wanted to work with. And there are a number of other people I think I could have worked with just as well, but I chose Bob, and I think that certainly I got a lot out of that, and started the initial directions of my career anyway, sort of the flavor of the physics I wanted to do and so on.
So what then drew you to work with Phil Anderson in Cambridge?
My dad was a professor of English literature and an Anglophile of some kind. And throughout my childhood, I sort of came to believe that the luckiest thing that could ever happen to me would be to go to Oxford or Cambridge. So that set me looking at, who was working in Cambridge and Oxford, and naturally Phil's name caught my attention because I knew a lot about what he'd done from my graduate studies. And so I spent two very happy years at the Cavendish. I would have liked to stay in England, I think, but then I got an offer from Chicago, which was really too good to turn down. And I really enjoyed my time there as well. And we had a group of young theorists all talk together all the time, so on.
So can you tell us a bit how the Cambridge group was functioning? How was it to interact in the theoretical physics subpart of the Cavendish?
Well, it was called the Theory of Condensed Matter group.
Okay.
And Volker Heine was actually the leader because he was there year round, whereas Phil was only there for half the year. And there were other junior faculty as well. And lots of postdocs, people who had college fellowships. It was a very pretty big group. Let's see, impressions that I want to mention are, well, twice a day we met for coffee time in the morning and tea time in the afternoon. This was an old building in the center of town. Things were pretty crowded. In the middle of the 2 years that I was there, we moved to the new building, which is outside of Cambridge. Well, outside of, it's in Cambridge, but it's outside of the center. It was very close. You knew everybody in the group from endless conversations at coffee twice a day. And one thing that struck me was it was much more informal than things had been at Penn. at Penn, you never knew just how you should address a professor. But in Cambridge, Phil was just Phil to everybody in the group, whatever age they were. So I enjoyed that. And I especially got a lot out of talking to Phil, as I guess you can guess, that directed me. That's where I first learned about spin glasses. Well, I didn't work on them till after I got to Chicago.
So were you roughly free to choose your research directions, or would Phil assign you a problem? How would that interaction work?
Well, in order to get money to pay me, I talked with him a little, and he suggested something, and he wrote an application to the Research Council to fund a postdoc, which was me. Okay. And basically I solved that problem in the first 6 months. That sounds too strong, because I got the basic idea and I wrote a FISREV letter. That led to further work, especially with David Edwards at Imperial College. He was a co-author with me on the paper. And but Phil was kind of pleased that essentially what he'd promised to do on in the grant application, he could say it was done. And so I spent, naturally more time developing that, but a lot of time just taking advantage of what I could learn from people there. For a while, there was something which I had a lot of conversations with Ario Tassati and Richard Palmer, who were working on an idea about neutron stars at the time. And naturally, I learned about spin glasses from Phil, and I remember especially his More is Different lecture. It was published in Science around then, but in any case, I saw a copy of it, and I thought, you know, this is the way I like to think about physics.
So you mentioned that you've heard about spinning glasses at that point. Can you tell us a bit how that came about? Was it through seminars, or was it just Phil talking about spinning glasses, or what?
It was just conversations with Phil. You know, I would go into his office and we'd talk, and sometimes there'd be a paper lying on the table there, and I would ask about it. I think that's, and he had definite ideas about it. It was a different field, of course, at that time. It was just based on very phenomenological, trying to understand, or characterize more than understand, the slow dynamics. And it wasn't really till the Edwards Anderson paper, which came out after I left Cambridge, that.
So did you follow?
Yeah, it got to be a real theoretical physics problem.
So did you follow the development of those ideas associated with the Edwards and Anderson paper, or did you learn about it like everyone else from the published literature?
By the time I really started, you know, thinking about working on it, as opposed to, you know, this is good for me to learn about another idea. Then I'd been in Chicago for a year or something, and you know, I used to go back to the Cavendish in the summers sometimes. I remember talking with Sam then, Edwards, and so now we're getting into replicas, I think. And I was always skeptical about replicas in the beginning, partly because in Chicago, I interacted, at least talked a lot with Shang Ma, who, he was in San Diego, but he was working with Gene Mazenko, who was in the office next to me. And I would see him at meetings, or I guess before that I met him when I went to Stanford and he was there. And he always had such a nice direct approach to stuff. He and Gene had this way of doing dynamical renormalization group calculations without replicas for random systems, just by formally averaging about how to average the graphs over the disorder. And I thought, okay, I'm much happier with this. I guess throughout my years of working on spin glasses, I don't think I ever published a replica calculation. It was something I had to learn about, see what other people were doing. But aside from the initial lack of transparency about what it meant, well, that was cleared up a lot, of course, by Parisi and Mazzard. But I had some kind of skepticism about why you would want to do an equilibrium calculation about something that was never going to get to equilibrium. So, I did a lot of papers, I think, on dynamics of spin glasses. And of course, it was interesting to eventually learn how the natural dynamics calculation led to something which was related to, but not identical to, but certainly strongly connected to one-step RSB.
We're going to get to your work on dynamics a bit later. If you don't mind, I'd like to, you know, keep talking a bit about this period. So you said you were discussing with Sam Edwards over the summer. So you heard about the calculation that they were doing, him and Phil, before it got published. Did you also, I mean, did they send you a preprint of that work as well? Were you part of the group?
I'm quite sure I saw it. I mean, in those days, everybody got preprints all over the place. Now we have a different method with the archive, but we had preprint libraries and everything. Mm-hmm.
In your first paper on spin glasses, it's called Gauge Model for Spin Glasses. You mentioned that you started thinking about that particular topic during a visit at the LPS in Orsay. Can you detail that interactions? Mm-hmm. And also, who were you interacting with in Orsay? And I'll get to, in particular, right, did you then hear about André Blandin's work about replica symmetry breaking?
Well, I can remember talking to him then. I can't remember whether it was about replica symmetry breaking at that point or not. And I went to Orsay to collaborate with Zazie Bale-Manoh. But spin glasses had gotten on my mind. And I think she was kind of disappointed that I didn't spend as much time talking with her I also talked with Philippe Mono, who was interested in experiments on spin glasses. But I don't know. I think, I was seduced by gauge theory and the exciting things in particle physics at the time. And just enjoyed this thing that the ideas from one remote part of physics can be used for some insight in another part. And I when I wrote that paper, I didn't really understand that what I was talking about was a glass of things with Jalashinsky-Maria interactions. But at least that got me into the field in an active way.
So you started working also with Richard Clem following an Aspen meeting, the 1977 US-USSR meeting on condensed matter. How did that collaboration come about in that context, and what were you then trying to achieve with this work?
I think we were just trying to see what we could learn about spin glass state, the transition, and so on, just using dynamical methods. And so we explored a few different models and I think in retrospect it wasn't so profound, but we were just feeling our way through this. And nobody else in Chicago was working on spin glasses, and Richard was sort of the nearest person who was interested in working with me on it. So,
Did you meet him at Aspen actually, or did you know him from before?
I'm pretty sure I met him before. Probably that interaction started in Aspen.
So afterwards, with your postdoc, Anil Khurana, you work on the instability of the Edwards-Anderson order parameter, or the RS solution, without replicas, roughly in parallel to Parisi's formulation of the RSB scheme. How closely were you following these advances, and what was your reaction or impression to the work at the time?
My reaction to Giorgio's work?
Yes, yeah. The interaction it had with your own research.
Right? Well, it seemed like he really had something there. Although I don't think any of us really fully understood it initially, why this replica symmetry breaking, and in particular, infinite replica symmetry breaking, why that should be the way you handled this. So I thought, well, you know, maybe there's some way to get to this through dynamics. And so first we were just trying to see what we could do with this, tricks with the simple and fairly naive dynamics, and see if we could begin to see some connection, which I don't think we did. Maybe now we understand why. But that was our motivation in any case.
Shortly afterwards, or actually in the middle of that effort, you moved from Chicago to Nordita. So you kept working on spin glasses through that move. Were you then interacting more with the Paris, Rome, or UK communities on spin glasses? Or how connected or isolated were you at Nordita compared to, say, Chicago?
I would say at the beginning, I was equally isolated. But now I'm trying to remember when it was. After a few years, maybe 2 years it was or something, I'm really not exactly sure, but somewhere I had some conversations with David Sherrington, probably on a visit to Oxford. And he and Giorgio, and I guess maybe Heinz Horner, were involved in a little network that was supported by the EU. Originally, it was some kind of EU funding. And he just invited me to join the meetings. So there was nothing official about it, but that's how I kind of got connected. So I remember, certainly as early as about 83, probably also 82, but I'm not sure, going to some meetings in Paris and maybe somewhere else, but I can't remember.
You wrote another works on the dynamics of spin glasses, you know, called, there's a series of paper called Dynamical Mean Field Theory for Spin Glasses. So how did this idea of looking at dynamics again, or from this different angle, come about? And did you interact or get inspired by the work of Sampolinski and Zimpelius, who had taken place a little before?
Basically, I was trying to understand what Heim had done. It seemed like he didn't take it to its conclusion. Well, or what I hoped was its conclusion, was that you could really see a direct correspondence with Parisi's replica calculations. And I was doing, in some sense, it was trying to do a poor man's version of Heim's, or maybe making stuff more explicit, just so I understood it better myself. And, you know, I was wondering, I think, you know, was there some simple kind of ansatz that got you to complete it? And I was never sure that I had one. But I thought, well, let me write the paper and see if anybody reacts to it. And, you know, if maybe somebody uses it to develop an idea, take things further. But I'd been sort of sitting on it for a long time. And I thought, well, let's get it out and see what anybody thinks of it. I think it was largely neglected, at least don't remember any useful conversations with people that came out of that. But that was my thinking at the time.
So can you provide us some perspective on what was the relationship between people who were thinking about dynamics and the replica results, or the replica symmetry breaking results? Was this, I mean, were there a lot of ideas floating in the air? Was this something that was confusing people, or what? I don't know, actually, I'm trying to.
Yeah, I don't know. I had the feeling at the time you were either doing replicas or you were doing dynamics. And in Heim's work, I saw the possibility of a connection. But it didn't seem to me that it actually really solved the problem. I think in retrospect, if I had been in Jerusalem then or something and got to talk about stuff and argue over it with Heim, maybe something more would have come out of it. But really, there was virtually nobody else in Scandinavia working on these things. And I was connected through this network that David and Giorgio started. There were lots of interesting conversations, but I never achieved what I had hoped that might lead to.
I mean, there was some efforts in the group of Alfs Sjölander and related think about dynamics. What was your interaction, or what was your perspective on these dynamical efforts that came from a completely different perspective?
Of course, these are the ones which are connected to one step RSB, and that was a really interesting connection when it became clear. But I think I was really focused on, you know, canonical SK spin glasses, and I didn't see how to make a connection between the Sjölander and also Goetz's work. But I think they were looking at the problem the same way I was looking at the problem. We were looking at different problems, but what are the methods of statistical dynamics? What light can they shed on this problem? So I was a little surprised that they found something so neat in that problem that I couldn't really drag out of the spin glass problem.
Francesco?
Yes, you mentioned that at the time people were kind of either doing replicas or dynamics. So I wanted to know, there was an early paper by the Dominicis in 1978, which is entitled dynamics as a substitute for replicas in random systems, I think. So that paper was not like, and I think it was one of the first instances where the connection between dynamics and replicas was formulated. So
no, you
are saying that paper was not very well known or understood at the time yet. That is it correct?
No, I was certainly well aware of that paper. I studied it a lot. And I think everybody in the community knew about it. And of all the people sort of in this field back in around 1980 or something, I probably talked more with Cyrano than anybody else. The connection between replicas and dynamics was quite clear in for the random J Ising model. But it wasn't ever clear how to just, it wasn't such a straightforward thing when you tried to look at spin glasses. But really that paper was kind of my inspiration for trying to study dynamics the way I did.
So two, three years later, you switched gear and started working on neural networks starting around 1986. And you had a series of work in collaboration with Sara Sola and Jeffrey Grinstein. How did that transition and that collaboration take place? Can you walk us through?
Yeah, I guess I got interested in the problem a couple of years before when I spent half a year at the Institute in Santa Barbara, and Richard Palmer was there, and he'd worked with John Hopfield, and so I learned about Hopfield models at that point, and I started going to some meetings.
So this would have been 1984?
Well, it started in 1983, because that was the year I was in Santa Barbara.
Okay.
So in 84, I was trying to learn all about this stuff. And I was visiting IBM in Yorktown fairly frequently in those years. And I think it was 85. Anyway, I was there basically invited by Jeff, and Sarah was postdoc then. And there was that, at the time when the Hopfield model was new, and immediate questions were, okay, how can we make this more realistic? And the obvious thing, once you learn about real neurons, is that the connections between them are not symmetric. So when you have an Ising model with asymmetric connections, then you can't do equilibrium statistical mechanics. You can look for steady states, but they're not Gibbs equilibria. But you can use all the tools that I was using on spin glasses to study that. And so it was a fairly simple thing that Jeff and Sarah and I did. We just took a simple soft spin spin glass. Just the matrix was asymmetric instead of symmetric, and showed how you could, what that did to the spin glass transition. Well, it would drive away the spin glass transition. But you could still do the Hopfield calculation for the stability of the memory states. We wrote up something which was, I think, for a conference proceedings on neural networks that I went to in Utah. And then I think I talked about it at a meeting in Heidelberg that Heinz Horner organized. And Leo Van Hemmen said something, oh, you really ought to write this up more fully. And so I think we did. And of course, by this time, Haim had already done similar calculations.
So, and you wrote a paper with Giorgio as well, I think.
I wrote a paper with Giorgio.
Okay, so that's my mistake.
Not that I remember.
So you then work. So were you then at the ITP meeting in Santa Barbara, I think in 86, and at the Institute of Advanced Studies meeting in Jerusalem on neural networks? And if yes, how important were these gatherings from your perspective?
I don't think I was at either of those.
Okay.
I mean, at this point, I was still, at least my mind was still a lot on spin glasses, and I was learning a lot of neural networks and learning about the calculations other people were doing. I got involved in, there were some replica calculations now that I think of it. So on statistical mechanics of learning, and I had a very good student, Holm Schwarze, who did his thesis on that. And so these were on things like statistical mechanics of committee machines and so on. Yeah, so that's where I actually did some replica calculations. One step, anyway. But mainly while at the same time, I had an old friend from college who worked at the NIH, a neurophysiologist, Barry Richmond. And, you know, he was telling me, can you tell me maybe we can use some neural networks in analyzing our data? He was especially concerned in measuring information transmission in the visual system. And it ended up with a few years later, after a lot of visits one way or the other, I spent a year at the NIH. They actually hired me a permanent position, but I never intended to leave Nordita. So we developed ways of using conventional layered neural networks to just as a tool in statistical tool in measuring the information transmission in Barry's experiments. But I'd say for most of the 20 years after that, leading up to just the last few years anyway, I became more of a neuroscientist than a physicist. And certainly throughout until around the turn of the century, I was still working on some things in spin glasses, trying to studied, I remember one thing on dynamics of polymers. And by this time, David and Giorgio's network had developed into a bigger thing funded by the European Science Foundation. And we had regular meetings, pretty 50 people or so. And I was doing some calculations on since Spin Class Dynamics with David Sherrington, and spent a lot of time visiting Oxford, partly motivated by the fact that my son was studying at Oxford and it was an excuse to go there. But I always like to go to Oxford in, under any circumstances. In recent years, I've had an office in both the physics department and the neuroscience department here. In the middle of this, Nordita moved to Stockholm, so I have an office there too, which I haven't been to since the pandemic started, but hope to go back soon. Certainly in the last 10 years, it's been more concerned with problems in neuroscience.
So to take a step back again, you mentioned that you met Richard Palmer when he was a grad student in Cambridge. Yeah. And then that you met him again and interacted with him again at the ITP in 1983. And actually in 1988, you went for a sabbatical at Duke. So can you tell us?
Yeah, he invited me to go there. And
were you in touch throughout? Were you close friends? Or how did that visit to Duke get organized?
I wouldn't say we were close friends, but we were in touch. And I think it was quite largely his initiative to suggest that I come to Duke. And the duty that I would have would be to teach a course or help teach a course on this, because people were getting interested in it, and the students wanted to know, but there was nobody besides Richard who had any knowledge whatever. And I was really more involved already then in the understanding the tech engineering style developments, learning back propagation and so on. So we taught the course together. They had a scheme there where there's a bunch of universities right in that neighborhood. Oh, you're right there, so you know about this. So this was a course put on television for people in rooms at NC State and UNC, as well as at Duke. And my first experience with remote teaching, trying to remember to look at the screen to see whether somebody had a question in Chapel Hill. Because we didn't have a textbook or anything, I wrote up lecture notes on LaTeX. We handed out to the students, and Richard did for the things that he gave the lectures on. So by the end of the course, we had a little pile of these things, but it wouldn't have gone anywhere except that Jack Cowan came from Chicago, came for a visit. And he saw these, we were talking in Richard's office, and he saw these things lying on the table and says, "What's that?" And he was supposed to collect things for a volume for Springer. And on this, sorry, that was the idea. And so he said, "Could we use these?" And Richard and I talked about it. And also should mention my student, then student, Honest Crow, was there, and he had a lot to do with helping in the teaching and preparing the notes too. I mean, he writes better than I do. So does Richard. I'm not the good writer of the group, but fortunately I had really good co-authors there. And so we said, we would like to maybe make this into a book of some kind. But Richard was already associated with the Santa Fe Institute then. And so basically because it meant, he cared about this more than either Anders or I did. And so we decided it didn't go to Springer, but it went in this Santa Fe series with the blue cover by which it's been known since then. I think we spent the next year converting the notes into something we could not be ashamed of to publish as a book. I enjoyed writing it. I was writing a book on Spinglasses around the same time, which started earlier with Conrad Fischer from Jülich. But the Spinglass book was actually finished later than the Neural Networks one.
The book on Neural Network was, I think, or amongst the very first on the topic to be published, right? And it seemed to have been reasonably well received. Is that correct? And if yes, was there ever a discussion or a possibility of creating a second edition or was it already seen to be complete in a sense?
No, in the mid 90s, I can't remember, I think it was the mid 90s. The barrier to doing it was that both Richard and Anders had gone off into totally different fields. And in fact, I was not really involved in neural network research much by that time. So it would be a big learning job for us to capture all the new stuff. But it almost happened because Sarah Soy was visiting in Copenhagen once, and she said, "Well, I could take Anders's place The problem was that before we got started, Richard had a stroke. And he really wasn't able to do this. And we just kind of got discouraged at that point. I think now the book is still useful to people. Bernhard Mehlig in Gothenburg has written, I think it's just out now, a modern version, which seems to me to have the same kind of flavor that we had, but it leaves out the things from ours, which have now become seen as less important, and put things about the the new exciting developments in it in their place. So somebody is looking for an updated version. I think I would recommend they go to Bernhard's book, which I like very much.
I mean, you mentioned the other book that you were co-authoring at the same time with Conrad Fischer. How did that book project come about, and why was it the natural time to publish such a book when you did?
I think because there was no book on Spinglasses. In a way, the book by Mark and Giorgio and Miguel sort of came out first. It wasn't the same sort of monograph that ours was, but it wound up being the first thing people went to learn about the field. And ours, really, because of Conrad's rooting in experiments and so on, ours had a different kind of emphasis on issues which maybe have gone to the back burner when the excitement of RSB and what Rome and Paris people could do with it. This is really something new and important in physics, and not just important. It was more than that. And that's what the Nobel Committee has recognized finally this year. Well, I think it was a little overdue. Just that we have some math for describing at least some classes of highly complex things. And that it started out with worrying about some messy magnetic alloys is now kind of irrelevant. It's all the broader impacts.
So how did you know Conrad Fischer? How did you got to start on this project? And right.
I can't remember how it started. But when I was working on those problems that I worked on in back in Cambridge, the initial problem with Phil Anderson, that led me to connections with people in Jülich. So the relevant experiments there were photo emission, and they had a very good photo emission group there. And so early in my time in Cambridge, I established connections with the was then called Institute for Festkörperforschung in Jülich, which I don't think exists, at least not under that name anymore. And so I met a number of other people, and when I got interested in spin glasses, there were other people there. Wolfgang Kinzel was there at the time. And I had a lot of interactions with his group over the years, more after he moved to Würzburg. But I first met him in Jülich.
Okay. As you mentioned, after the book, your interest in pure spin glasses or pure problems sort of slowly vanished. But did you keep abreast of the field? Were you following the advances that were happening, and in particular, right in the mid 90s, Silvio Franz was at Nordita.
Yeah,
it's at the time where he formulated the Franz-Parisi potential. Were you then discussing with him? Were you following what was happening?
Yeah, I was. I was hearing a lot about it from Silvio all the time. But what we were doing was a little bit different. It was dynamics. And I think also with my commitments in neuroscience and so on, it was a matter of that there's only 24 hours in the day. So these things like the Parisi-Franz potential, and so I only sort of followed them passively.
Okay. After this initial contact with David Sherrington and the meetings, we understand that you became part of some of the European networks on spinning glasses and related ideas.
Yeah, when they made the expanded version of it, the European Science Foundation. It had a council with representatives from the various countries that people were in. I was the Danish representative, and informally was supposed to represent other Scandinavian people too. There were regular, group met for a big conference every year, and I always went to those, and that's where I got to know people like Irena and I'm blocking on his name, but the other Parisi students and
so Andrea Cavagna, is that who you were?
Yeah, Andrea Cavagna. Yeah.
Okay.
And before that, Jorge and
Leticia. Leticia,
yes.
From your viewpoint as having bridged both sides of the Atlantic scientifically and geographically, how do you understand the difference in interests in spin glasses and in replica symmetry breaking ideas between the US and Europe?
Well, I got the feeling that in the late 70s, funding agencies weren't interested in spin glasses. This was not why I left Chicago, but if I'd stayed, I would have worked on something else. But I think I got the impression that if this was something which was a lively and funded topic in Europe, but not so much in the States then. At least I didn't know of any. Heim spent some time at Bell Labs. That was just on Bell Labs funding. So he had independence to do that there.
And Phil Anderson at Princeton did some work in the mid 80s as well. I mean, were you, at that point, were you still in touch with him, or do you have an idea of how he was thinking about spin glasses and replica symmetry breaking?
I did visit Princeton a couple of times, but I wasn't really in touch with Phil. Things were changing in the field, changing radically around the time I went came to Europe. But I had the impression then all the action was here in Europe. All the people in Paris and Rome and also other places, else, England. But I didn't know anybody working on this in America.
Francesco?
Do you have, I wanted to know, I mean, do you have an opinion or an idea of why it was like that? It was like a fluctuation, or there was some underlying reason for this difference in interest and also especially in funding on the two sides of the Atlantic?
Well, I think one advantage we had in Europe was there were many countries, many research councils, and even if one of them is negative, another one might be positive. It kind of gave more opportunity for new ways of thinking sneaking into the system. I got the impression in the States that it was more, you know, people were thinking about materials problems. And there were lots of exciting ones of those. But no, maybe the field just lacked a big vocal advocate.
But in principle, what has always kind of puzzled me is that Phil Anderson, so he was probably one of the strongest advocates for the idea of universality of spin glasses and the fact that spin glasses could be a prototype of complex system with broad applications. And he was in the US and he was very influential. And still, it seems that this didn't really create a community at the time working on this. Like
yeah, I mean, in retrospect, that is curious. But, you know, Phil had his fingers in so many different problems. You know, in Europe, the people working on spin glasses, this was our main interest. And, well, I mean, obviously, especially Giorgio has to get credit for building up a school. I think Mark learned this stuff from him. And also David Sherrington was instrumental as well. And a lot of students working on this for years, and was maybe his main interest as well.
So you mentioned a class you taught that had spin glass flavors to it at Duke, but did you ever teach a class that that mentioned spin glasses and replica symmetry breaking in Chicago and Nordita or elsewhere? And if yes, can you detail?
Okay, not in Chicago. I mean, I gave courses in applications of quantum field theory to condensed matter there. But in Nordita, I gave courses on statistical dynamics generally. And also on disordered systems. And I guess, yeah, probably fair to say in these that paper from Cyrano from 1978 that you mentioned earlier was sort of at the root of those. And yeah, I never gave one which was specifically on spin glasses, but spin glasses were involved in both of those.
So when would this have started, just to get an idea of time?
Well, okay, as a Nordita, we didn't have teaching obligations, but so I didn't teach every year, but I taught maybe once every other year or something. In the 80s, it was on disordered systems generally, and by the 90s, it was the course given several times was on statistical dynamics, and let's see now. Well, when Nordita moved to Stockholm, I did give one course there because people wanted to know about the renormalization group. And so I said, okay, I'll try to do that. But that wasn't really about spin glasses at all. That was just about using renormalization group methods. And I taught myself a new way of doing it in order to teach that. That's the operator algebra method that's in John Carty's book.
So is there anything else you'd like to share with us about this idea that we may have missed or skipped over?
Well, let's see. I still have questions about replicas. I mean, maybe if I'd stayed in the middle of the action and kept working with Sylvia, I wouldn't have these questions. But all right, one of them is, why is it either 0, 1, or infinity? That you either have no replica symmetry breaking, or one step, or infinite. Are there no systems where 2 or 3 would be relevant? Could you make up some?
There are.
Maybe people have made these up now, but I always wondered about that.
There are, but they're not natural in some sense. You have to cook up a system that has that. It's strange, yes.
Whereas and I also wonder, all the things that we treat with one step, why is one step enough? Are we sure that one step is enough? I don't work on this, but I still wonder about things like that.
So in closing, do you still have notes, papers, or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
I don't have any notes from then. I never saved. Saved old calculations once they got published. Sometimes if there was some special thing that didn't make it into the paper, but I thought might be useful for the future. But I've had to move offices several times, and I never had whatever old notes I had organized well enough to have saved them in a systematic way. So I'm afraid I don't have anything to contribute to archives from that.
And no correspondence with Phil or with Richard or with David Sherrington or throughout those years either.
No, I mean, probably all my emails with everybody are still on the Niels Bohr Institute server somewhere. What I have here on my desk right now, they only go back as old as this machine is, because I had trouble transferring old mail to it when I got it. So that goes back 7 years. This is getting to be an old machine. Next time I can get back to Stockholm to Nordida, I intend to try to replace it. But it's still working fine for now. But anyway, that's why my correspondence goes back that long. But I do save all that. But I have to say, I haven't looked at old stuff for a long time.
Thank you very much for your time for this conversation.
Well, thank you. It's been interesting talking to you. And I happened to look at the website that your initial mail mentioned. So these are things there. I didn't look at them, but I can look at other people's interviews on that.
Thank you.